The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
Thank you for joining us this week for Veterans Chronicles. Our guests are Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North and Lieutenant Brian Jackson, a U.S. Naval Academy grad with 22 years of service as a U.S. Marine. Colonel North's awards for combat include the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for Valor, and two Purple Hearts for wounds suffered in combat. Author of 11 New York Times bestsellers, his book American Heroes in the Fight Against Radical Islam is based on his extensive coverage of U.S. military units engaged in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Philippines.
Colonel, reading the stories you outline in your book, it's clear where your inspiration to do this book came from. These really are remarkable young men and women, are they not?
They are indeed, Gene, and you know that from personal experience. You and I both have great affection for them, and unfortunately, many of our colleagues in the mainstream media never give them the credit that they deserve or the attention that they warrant in ways that it should be given.
Well, let's talk about the media for a little bit. I was reading a book by Michael Yon last night. This sentence struck me. There is a clear battlefield conversion from ink to blood, from blood to ink. In other words, how the media treats perceived wins and losses.
Yeah, and Michael's, and I'm not bragging, whining, or complaining, but Michael's one of the very few guys that's got more time on the ground out there than I do.
Right.
And that's one of the problems. You know, you could probably count on the fingers of one hand the people that have actually gone out there, live with American soldiers, sailors, airmen, guardsmen, and Marines for months on end, and let them tell their story. Michael's done that. That's what this book is about. That's what a lot of stuff should be about. I mean, in fact, there should have been a lot more of that, particularly given that we've got, you know, a war that started ostensibly for us on September 11, 2001, and it's now been ongoing for that protracted period of time. Over a million young Americans have served in it, and yet very few of them have gotten the kind of recognition and credit that they deserve, in large part because so few people from the Western media, and particularly the American media, have spent time in the field with them. They were there for the run-up, you know, and the days of March of 2003, and once Baghdad was liberated, they went home. And I'm grateful that Roger Ailes and Fox News Channel have sent me back out there repeatedly. And again, not because I like war. I think anybody who's ever been to a war ought to hate war, and certainly these guys do. But I don't hate the warriors, and that's the problem. We've got too many people in the media that, you know, they'll go out there for a few days and they'll buy an air-conditioned hotel room and they'll stand up on a balcony and they'll show the tape that was essentially shot by a guy carrying a camera that says Al Jazeera, Arachnia, Al Arabiya, Lebanon 4, which is the Hezbollah channel in Lebanon, or Iranian TV on the side of it. And we're getting the images of war brought to us by the enemy. And I'm not talking about CBS or anything like that. I'm talking about the enemy photographers are there on the ground with the bad guys. Very few people spending any time with the good guys.
Hmm. Our son is now doing his second tour in Iraq. He's an assistant operations battalion officer this time around. He led a platoon before. When he got this assignment, his reaction was, you know, this is not what I want. I want to go to Afghanistan because that's where the action is.
Well, it is now. I mean, for the Marines, at least. I mean, there's certainly a lot of the surge forces are now coming back home. The Marine operations that have been conducted extensively now for 5 years in Al-Anbar province, because Al-Anbar is one of the safest places in all of Iraq and, quite frankly, on the planet. But it was a bloodbath for 3 years out there. And Ramadi, Iraq, and Fallujah, Iraq, are places that, for the Marines and the Army Brigade that's been out there, they will never forget it. And they're the ones that started the awakening movement, which flourished with a surge. And the pictures, as you know, Gene, are in this book of the guys who began that, not just the Americans, but some very, very brave Iraqis like Sattar, the guys today that are carrying it out like Abbas and Captain Nazir, who's back there on page 263, and those remarkable Iraqis who have stood up and said, we've had enough of this. We're not going to let the radical Islamics take over our country. We're not going to let the Iranians take over our country. We want an Iraq that is safe and secure for our families, that's prosperous because of the oil wealth underneath it. And to a very large extent, they're getting there a lot faster than, quite frankly, I thought possible, given all the time I've spent on the ground.
Well, so the Petraeus-Odiero strategy has really paid off.
It has. Gene, and again, here's another case of, you know, no good deed shall go unpunished. You know, General Petraeus is a man who had a vision for what this war could become, how it should be prosecuted, was pilloried when he came back and testified the first time. And we all know it, none of us will ever forget that newspaper ad in the New York Times or the way he was derided by members of Congress. Second testimony here a few weeks ago wasn't quite so fierce, but in fact, if the other side gets the slot in the Oval Office, he's finished. And he's finished because he's prosecuted this war in a way that he wants to achieve a victory. And that's exactly what his soldiers and sailors and airmen and guardsmen and Marines want. I mean, there's not a single stage photograph in this book. Most of them are taken from frames from my combat camera. And there's not a single quote that's doctored in this book. These are the young Americans like your son who are out there who want this war to be won. I can't tell you, Gene, how many have said to me, Colonel, I don't want this war to end like the war you fought in as a young officer in Vietnam.
Well, isn't it ironic, though, that the critics of Petraeus won't even to this day, at least many of them, admit that any progress at all has been made?
Oh, indeed. In fact, as soon as the news started to turn good from Iraq, it disappeared from the front pages of the paper, dropped off the evening news, and it's though it's a forgotten place, except when a Humvee rolls over or an IED goes off. And I wouldn't kid you. I mean, Iraq is still a dangerous place. But, you know, Ramadi, Iraq, which is roughly the same size as Philadelphia, is today a safer city than Philadelphia.
Well, there's a picture of you in the book showing you walking around without a flak jacket on. You said it's the first time in many visits there you hadn't been shot at.
Yeah. In fact, 9 trips out there to Ramadi, and I took off my flak jacket and my helmet and walked into the souk, and the translator, the TERP, interpreter as the troops would call him, has been out there with Marine units and Army units and now a Navy SEAL unit. And so I said to him, you know, I'm going to go into the souk, which was closed before. I mean, it was a battle zone. And I want to buy, because the gold souk in Ramadi is very famous.
Mm-hmm.
I want to buy my wife a bracelet, and I want to buy my grandchildren some trinkets and stuff. And so the TERP walks in with me. And he calls me Ali, not Ali, Ali. And he says, We go along, and he helps me negotiate because my Arabic isn't really all that good. And we come out with a gold bracelet for my wife and some ski hats, you know, the little stocking caps and scarves for my kids with the Iraqi flag on them.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to me when we get back in the car, he says, you know, Ali, he says, you did a very good negotiation. You got a good deal on the gold bracelet. You got screwed on the trinkets. But you couldn't even go there before.
Yeah,
you didn't dare go there before. And so it has turned around dramatically because of Petraeus changing the landscape with the surge, the way in which they go into an area, hold it, and an Iraqi police unit, an Iraqi army unit, Iraqi security forces move in, and the people respond incredibly favorably.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've now signed up, 30,000 young Iraqis have volunteered to become part of the Sons of Iraq, the volunteer community policing organizations. And this month, the Iraqis are going to pick up paying them. We've been paying them. The Americans have been paying them out of the commander's discretionary funds. And the Iraqis are now going to start paying, and they should, because, you know, at $124 a barrel for oil, they can afford to.
Absolutely. A couple of points that struck me about what you wrote, I want to explore them a little bit. Post-traumatic stress disorder. You were a big debunker of that notion for a very long time. You seem to have changed your mind. Why?
Well, Gene, I spent, you know, a quarter of a century wearing a uniform. I've been in combat a bunch. And I kind of believed that a size 10 on the backside was all you needed to get somebody out of it. And then I watched, in fact, I just stepped off an armored vehicle that then backed over an improvised explosive device, blew it in two, killed nine, terribly wounded 12 more, and most of them terribly burned. The gunnery sergeant from that unit broke down the next day. And I was sitting across from a Navy lieutenant commander, a medical officer, and I watched it happen. Here's a fierce, tough gunnery sergeant who's been in combat a bunch of times in Afghanistan. He'd been in Kosovo. He'd been in the first Gulf War. I mean, this guy had been around. He cracked up, and is in large part because he had lost so many of his boys. Master's degree, by the way, the gunnery sergeant. Totally unlike what the depiction in the media would be of a Marine senior non-commissioned officer. And the doctor said to me after he came back from, you know, they evacuated him, and he eventually ended up back in the States. But at that time, the doc came back to Chow, and I said, what the heck was wrong with him? He said, you don't get it, do you? He said, let me tell you, PTSD is an injury. It is just the same as a shrapnel wound. Some people recover faster than others. Some people deal with it differently than others. I mean, you and I both know a young Marine who lost both his legs out there. And it was a remarkable example of resilience. He's in the book. He's a friend of your family, and he's gotten to be a friend of mine. And we know that he's dealt with that incredible trauma far better than other people with lesser injuries.
We'll continue our conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, author of the recently revised and expanded American Heroes in the Fight Against Radical Islam, after we return on Veterans Chronicles.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veteran Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles with Gene Pell. Joining him is Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, distinguished author and veteran, to continue their conversation on PTSD and its devastating effects on soldiers.
So by the time I got back to the States, you know, I mulled it over a good bit. I went to Bethesda and Walter Reed and Brook Army Medical Center to see the guys that had been wounded out there and talk to the doctors about it. And what I wrote about it in this book is from my heart. You know, we don't do enough to recognize that there are guys, young commanders like I was, that believe that a size 10 is all you need. But when you've got these massive IEDs that kill, you know, not just one or two people at a time, but dozens, and they have traumatic brain injuries, TBI, which don't manifest themselves with blood in many cases. Those kinds of injuries, and that's what they are, need to be treated. And we don't really spend enough doing that kind of thing, either in the VA system. The military's gotten a lot better at it, but in helping these people recover and get back to productive lives.
One of the things that strikes me about the young lieutenant you were talking about, who lost both his legs, and we do know him very well, he comes from a very, very strong family, and he has a very, very strong faith.
Amen. And in large part, and again, this is in the book, those who come from close family relationships, those who have and that kind of support network and a very strong spiritual background are less likely to be adversely affected by PTSD or any other kind of injury out there. And as you know, Gene, there are young soldiers, sailors, airmen, guardsmen, Marines who have been wounded in this war who would have died in any other war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, young Aaron Mankin, who's the combat camera guy with me and my team, who was blown to pieces on that LVT when it drove over that IED that I had just stepped off. Same situation for him. Good, strong family, good, strong faith. He's recovering. Other guys who didn't have that kind of, if you will, support, they didn't know what to fall back on. They didn't have that kind of grounding like, you know, young Jason, young Kynard and young Mankin. Those guys who didn't have that didn't do as well.
The other thing that struck me, well, there are many things there, but one that particularly struck me was you seem to have changed your attitude about women in war.
Well, you know, I would love to be in a situation where we never had to send a woman into harm's way. I still feel that way. And maybe that's because the good Lord blessed me with not just a son, but three lovely daughters as well. And I still have this thing about the chivalry, I suppose, that's inflicted upon you by growing up in the Army as I did and then serving in the Marines and now covering Marines and soldiers in harm's way still says we shouldn't have to do it. But as I wrote in the book, Amanda Honus was a great 50 caliber machine gunner. I don't like the idea of sending women in combat, but I love a good 50 caliber machine gunner. And Amanda Honus is one great 50 caliber machine gunner. And I'm alive today because she is. So, you know, you see these things, you see these citations for women who have done extraordinary things, remarkably brave, resilient. Nonetheless, I would still rather we'd be in a situation where we didn't have to. But let me make an observation very quickly. It is the women of Iraq who are changing that country, because women with purple fingers walking out of a voting booth aren't voting to have their sons become suicide terrorists. And it is the women of Iraq who are now part participants. I mean, half the society was unable to participate and economically, socially, politically, and they were denied everything that we would consider to be normal for a woman in this country. Because Americans wearing flak jackets and helmets have become protectors of Muslim women, the women are changing everything out there. And that's, I mean, they're now elected to office. They participate. It's about 65% of them go to the polls. I mean, that's higher than we get here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I you know, as I say, maybe it's because the good Lord blessed me with three lovely daughters, but, you know, our son would agree with me.
Let me ask you where we go from here in your view.
Well, I think, first of all, Afghanistan is going to become a focal point. A lot of this has to do with what Iran is doing. We need a strong ally, democratic. It's not going to be a Jeffersonian democracy in either one of those countries, but it is a representative government in both countries. We need strong allies in that part of the world. Iraq is about to become our strongest ally in the war against radical Islam. They've seen it firsthand. They don't want it, and they're about to become one of our strongest allies, far more so than any of the European countries, who are terrified about their Muslim populations becoming increasingly radicalized, possible exception of the Brits. And the Iraqis get it. The Afghanis are going to become the focal point for the resurrected Taliban, in large part because of what's not happening in western Pakistan. So you're going to see more of Afghanistan. That's probably the next place I'm going to go for Fox News Channel. I think that what we're doing is the right thing. I believe it. I believe that this war can be won. If it's lost, it will be lost in Washington, D.C., because the Congress either fails to fund what's necessary, or we end up with a commander-in-chief who wants, for his own political purposes, to lose this war in a way that we lost Vietnam.
We'll continue our conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, author of the recently revised and expanded American Heroes in the Fight Against Radical Islam, after we return on Veterans Chronicles.
Veterans Chronicles is now podcasting at RadioAmerica.org. Log on to our website, click on the podcasting icon, and look for Veterans Chronicles. Once there, follow the instructions on your computer to subscribe to our podcast. You'll always find our most recent program on the Veterans Chronicles podcast, in addition to past programs from our archives. The Veterans Chronicles podcast, free and online at RadioAmerica.org. Also available on Apple iTunes.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out, get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of batons.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest face.
Pass the ammunition and we'll all
cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles with Gene Pell. Joining him is Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, distinguished author and veteran.
I don't have the gift of prophecy to know which way it's going to go. But I will tell you this. If we end up with a Congress that cuts it off, like they did it in 1974 for the South Vietnamese, it wasn't the commander-in-chief. It was, you know, Jerry Ford wanted to keep helping the South Vietnamese.
And when they were winning.
They were. And in December of 1974, they cut them off. And by April of 75, it was over. This could go downhill that fast if Congress does the wrong thing. It could go down the same way if the new commander-in-chief decides I'm pulling everybody out tomorrow.
Well, on that note, I know you've got to run.
Let me just encourage you to hook up, Jim, on your website, the website American Heroes Book. com. The entire book signing schedule is out there, and I'd love to sign a book for real Americans that you broadcast to every day.
Hey, Ali, thanks so much for coming on. If you get back over in the Anbar area in the next few months and you're around Camp Baharia, look up our son.
I will do so, Gene. Appreciate very much you taking time to talk about this today and encourage people to go out there and get this book. God love you, brother.
Thanks to distinguished veteran and author Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North for sharing his experiences and perspectives on Iraq and Afghanistan. His book is called American Heroes in the Fight Against Radical Islam. It's published by the New American Library. Army Lieutenant Brian Jackson is one of those heroes and the recipient of the Distinguished Service Cross, second only to the Medal of Honor for Valor. Lieutenant Jackson shares his heroic tale from the Al-Anbar province during Operation Iraqi Freedom. We begin our discussion with his formative years and his decision to join the Army.
I was born in a Naval Air Station in Jacksonville, Florida, in 1982. I was born in a Navy family. My dad was a big influence on my life, growing up in a Navy family and moving about every 2 years my entire life from location to location, living on both coasts and also overseas in Japan. Really had a big influence on my decision to join the Army and also to go to West Point.
Well, now that's interesting right there. You're a son of a Navy family, but you decided to go to West Point. Why was that?
I think it was just an interest in the military in general and not necessarily a desire to go into one service.
And what was the experience at West Point like?
Very interesting. Going through a 47 intense military experience of every day living the military life, academically, physically, militarily. It was very intense.
What was your major?
I majored in American Legal Studies.
So what was your first assignment?
My first assignment was overseas in Germany, and I spent about a month in Germany preparing for a deployment to Iraq. And then I spent about 8 months deployed to Iraq before I was injured, and then I spent the next year doing rehabilitation and surgeries in at Walter Reed.
So this is now September 2006, right?
Yes.
You're in one of the most dangerous parts of the country. I assume it was Al-Anbar province?
Yes, it was. Okay. At the time, it was the most dangerous province in Iraq.
And what happened?
At the time, we were out in the sector responding to a mortar attack against one of our combat outposts, and I was with my company commander as his fire support officer, and we were responding to a mortar attack against, like I said, our outpost. And we were rounding up a couple detainees who we thought were responsible for attacking that base. And as we were about to pull out from the house where we detained the individuals, the Humvees became stuck in the mud. And so we got out, dismounted from the vehicles, and we were pulling security, and we looked around. I was outside the vehicle. Within short order, my commander and my first sergeant were both injured from machine gun fire. I looked over, and my first reaction was to take cover. I did, and everything happened pretty quickly. So it was kind of hazy, but a lot of what I remember is told to me secondhand. What I can remember is moving over across the road and assisting First Sergeant Sapp, one of the two soldiers who were injured, and helping provide first aid to him. But within about a minute of being next to him, I was injured myself from the machine gun fire. So I was returning fire myself where I thought the insurgents were shooting machine gun fire from. So I slouched over, lost consciousness, I was told. And when I came to, I returned fire again. Once I was unable to reload the magazine because of the loss of blood and I guess the shock of the injury, went back to doing first aid again on First Sergeant Sapp. I looked over and I saw Sergeant Newland, one of the other soldiers on the ground, who was towing the Humvee out of the mud at the time and also directing the gunners inside the other vehicles, the Bradley fighting vehicles, who were returning fire from those vehicles at the insurgents. And he was directing the soldiers from inside those vehicles to come over and help assist me in evacuating the commander and the first sergeant due to the severity of their wounds. And so he moved over and picked up the commander, and they evacuated the commander. It had an injury to his left leg, his femoral artery, so he was bleeding profusely. He had a severe injury to his leg. They put him in the back of the vehicle. Lieutenant Vo, a platoon leader on the ground, noticed his weapon was still out in the open, so he ran over. He came to pick up the weapon. When he did that, he was hit in the arm by machine gun fire, but he was still able to move and was ambulatory, so he got in the back of the vehicle. And Sergeant Newland, a second time, came back out under fire and moved over to assist me in picking up First Sergeant Sapp. And at that point, nobody knew that I was injured. I knew I was hurt, but I knew I still had to help evacuate First Sergeant Sapp. So I stood up and I helped carry First Sergeant Sapp to the back of the Bradley vehicle, which was only about 30 feet away.
But you're still under fire.
Exactly. The entire time we're under fire from two different machine gun positions. We don't know where they're at, but we're still returning fire generally where they're at. So we pick up First Sergeant Sapp. There's about four of us. Myself, Sergeant Newland, our medic, and another soldier. So we pick up First Sergeant Sapp. We start moving him. And I don't recall this, but I'm told that I was hit a third time from enemy fire as we were moving First Sergeant Sapp. But we keep pushing on, and we get in the back of the vehicle. And they lay down First Sergeant Sapp, and I grab his hand to comfort him. And the medic looks over at me, and he noticed I was injured, but I told him not to worry about me. And to keep stabilizing First Sergeant Sapp. So he did that. And so we all were loaded up in the back of the vehicles, and we pushed out to the field hospital. And in about 5 minutes, we were at that location. They offloaded us, and they all laid us down on the beds. The doctor started categorizing us based on our priority of our injuries. And I had a combat lifesaver come over and started stabilizing me. So at this point, that was the first time somebody had actually treated my injuries. And I was told by Sergeant Newland that I looked at him and I said, "Are you a medic?" And he said, "No, I'm not a medic." And I looked at him and said, I don't want a combat lifesaver, I want a medic, because I, at that point, knew everybody was taken care of, so now I was thinking, okay, now I want to make sure, you know, somebody's treating me that's trained and qualified, not somebody who's just first aid qualified. I want a real medic to look after me. So that was kind of a funny, surreal moment that I don't remember, but he apparently remembers it. But what was a really proud moment for me was knowing that after all that had happened, and that was only about 45 minutes to an hour of an eight-hour battle that ensued that day, Sergeant Newland and Lieutenant Vo got back into their vehicles and drove back out on the battlefield. And for the next 7 hours, fought the insurgents. Even after we were evacuated, they kept fighting the enemy, even after seeing all that that had happened so far in the day. So that was a really proud moment for me to know that they kept fighting the enemy. And when it was all said and done, they had rounded up 50 insurgents from a mosque that the enemy thought was a safe haven by shooting from a mosque. But we had sent in the Iraqi quick reaction force that day to the mosque, and they sent all those insurgents up to the airfield for prosecution. So for their actions that day, Sergeant Newland and Lieutenant Vo both received a Silver Star.
Oh, what happened to Sergeant Sapp, First Sergeant?
The captain and the first sergeant both recovered from their injuries. They both are actually still undergoing surgeries to this day. And I'm the most fortunate of all three of us, actually. But they survived that day, and they're doing very well.
You were at Walter Reed for how long?
I was there for a whole year.
There's a lot of controversy in the press about Walter Reed and the treatment and care the patients were being offered. What was your experience?
I was there both before and after that Washington Post article had come out. So initially when I arrived there, I had a great experience from the doctors. At the moment I arrived at the hospital, I was treated like a rock star. But it couldn't have been better as an inpatient. The problem that I had was when I was discharged as an outpatient, there were a lot of issues that I had experienced. From the second that I was sent home, to live home with my parents, there were a lot of issues I had, from not being treated properly in terms of my financial situation being sorted out properly, to the accountability of where I was supposed to be, you know, living at. When I was discharged, my case manager, the civilian case manager, was aware of where I was living, but the Army had somehow slipped through the cracks and accounting for where I was living at. As far as the Army was concerned, I was still back in Germany. So there's some issues in terms of accounting for where I was actually at. It was a little frustrating for me day in and day out to go into Walter Reed and to be my own advocate. So my parents were actually my best providers for my care. Only until I would go in there and I would vocalize the issues myself and say, look, you know, if this is happening to an Army lieutenant, you know, I can only wonder what it's like for an Army private. But by March of 2007, after this article had come out, it came to light. And then the Army had revamped a lot of the broken systems in place, and it started to get better. I think over time, Walter Reed became, I guess, the cornerstone of what the Army healthcare system should look like. So today, the Army is definitely in a better position in terms of the healthcare they provide. For all the other WTUs and different Army bases, Walter Reed is definitely the best representation of what it should look like.
When did you return to active duty?
Well, I was on active duty the whole time, but I finished convalescent leave at the end of November of 2007.
And is that when you were assigned to Asia?
Yes.
And what do you do over there?
Initially, when I went to Korea, I was a platoon leader for a rocket artillery battalion, and my second job was as a personnel officer.
Now, you graduated class 05 from West Point.
Yes, sir.
You must have made captain pretty early.
Yes, today you make captain in about 3 years.
How did you feel about the award that you were eventually given for your service in Iraq?
It was a very humbling experience, but the way I view it today is it's a representation of all the service that my unit had provided, and it's important to point out, in my task force, 136 Infantry, there were 7 soldiers who were awarded Silver Stars, and you don't hear about that very often, but the heroism that I saw every day was amazing and inspirational to me, and it really defines me, I think, as a leader, people that along the way made me who I am today and developed me along the way. From the beginning up until the present. And I'll never forget those people I served with.
Thanks to Lieutenant Brian Jackson for sharing his courageous tale of Operation Iraqi Freedom and for his continued service to the Army.